Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
What follows may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
The world is full of stories. Stories of mysteries. Of curiosities. Of oddities. Join Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
I like your earrings.
Thank you.
You don't usually wear dangly earrings.
No, not with short hair. I wear the danglies with long hair, but not with the short. It gives me a weird, like, ick, eccentric art teacher vibes. And it doesn't on other people, just on me. So, but I want to... You know, that's obviously something that goes on in here. I want to challenge it,
Okay. See
if I can power through.
So you have issued yourself a challenge to face your fear of looking like an eccentric art teacher.
Yeah.
That's lovely.
Yeah, well, you know me. I'm always challenging myself.
Pushing the limits.
Right.
Yeah.
Trying to be a better me.
Yeah. Scuba diving, skydiving.
Yep.
Replicating an eccentric art teacher look.
Yep.
Yeah.
All those things.
You're ticking the boxes off.
Pachow. Pachow.
No, you look very nice.
Thank you. You look very nice. I appreciate how you're wearing a shirt.
Yeah. I was not. We sat down to record a few moments ago, and Kat pointed out that I wasn't wearing a shirt and that my pants were undone.
Yeah.
I was distracted.
I also think that maybe it's a sign that you are comfortable, right?
Maybe
and that's a good thing.
That is a good thing, yeah.
I think,
yeah.
Maybe.
I think it's less me being more comfortable and more me being easily distracted because I have to set up lights and cameras and stuff now, and I'm not good at it.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah. We've talked about literally making a checklist because last week we started to record, but we weren't actually recording.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a lot of things to make sure you're doing right.
Well, I appreciate your patience because you had to sit there looking all pretty and stuff while I was running around shirtless adjusting the lighting scheme.
Patience? Really? I don't know.
I was giving you the opportunity to... pretend that you were patient.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was totally not rolling my eyes. It's fine.
Would you like to start this week?
I would love that.
Okay.
Thank you so much for asking.
Of course.
Yeah. Last week, we were chatting, and you brought up an email or a message from Kristen, and they wanted to know more about making wishes on things. And I thought, well, gosh, that's a great topic. Let's look into that.
Like, why do we wish on a falling star?
That's right.
And how does it change from culture to culture?
Yeah.
Interesting stuff.
I thought so. And good night.
That's it. Wow, I expected a little bit more.
You really did fill in some of the gaps. It changes from culture to culture, and it's really interesting.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty much...
All you wrote?
I mean, it's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
It's if you were to put it into a program and say, please summarize this. Mm-hmm. yeah, that's exactly what it would say.
What do you want from me? I'm wearing a shirt.
The tradition of wishing on a shooting star dates back to ancient times, and it's believed to have originated from various cultures independently. The idea that making a wish on a shooting star likely stems from the belief that these are rare and spectacular events and that they could be harbingers of good luck, or that they provide an opportunity to send wishes or prayers to heaven, okay, which would make more sense to me, sure, if they were shooting upward, but they are not.
Well, from your perspective, but the earth is round, so they could be shooting.
No.
Well, they're shooting downward, but from another part of the world, they might look like they're shooting upward.
That's never the case.
God.
No, because shooting stars aren't actually stars, they're meteors. And
sure,
so they're burning up as they come into our atmosphere. And
okay,
that means that it wouldn't be the case. But it's a good thought, sweetie.
I'm just thinking maybe if you're standing in the right, at the right angle, it might look, and in the proper place on the earth. It might
look. Should we Google it right now?
No, it's not that important.
No, okay.
Let's keep moving.
The exact origin of the tradition is difficult to pinpoint due to its widespread adoption across different cultures throughout history and the fact that it is believed to have originated from different cultures independently of themselves. In ancient Greece, shooting stars were often viewed as significant omens or signs from the gods. They were believed to carry messages or warnings from the divine realm, and the appearance of a shooting star was sometimes interpreted as communication from the gods regarding things that were going on Earth. And the Greeks associated shooting stars with both positive and negative events, depending on the context and the interpretation of the observers. There's a common belief that Ptolemy wrote that the gods occasionally, out of curiosity, even boredom, would peer down at the Earth from between the spheres, and stars sometimes slip out of the gap, like but it's more likely.
It's like Cheetos in your sofa cushions.
Something like that. Mega queso!
Yeah. I don't know if they have that type of Cheetos in
everywhere.
Yeah. Here, there's a kind of Cheetos that's just called mega queso.
Yeah, you can buy just regular queso Cheetos.
Right, right.
Or you can buy mega queso.
And the odd thing is, the regular Cheetos, which you would think weren't as queso-y,
mm-hmm,
is in a darker orange package, where the mega queso is in a yellow package. That seems to be backwards to me.
So orange to you indicates a higher concentration of queso. Yeah.
Orange is the universal color for mega queso.
So weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's more likely that Ptolemy saw shooting stars as a phenomenon occurring within Earth's atmosphere. He likely thought that they were caused by exhalations from the Earth. So they were going up.
Oh.
Yeah. That were set aflame in higher regions of the atmosphere. But for some reason, there is this widespread belief that he wrote about shooting stars and the gods. But I couldn't find anything that would substantiate that at all, which
interesting.
Is interesting. People also make wishes on birthday candles, eyelashes, wishbones, coins thrown into fountains. Let's take a look now at some of the things that we wish upon. And why?
Okay.
In the 18th century in Britain and Ireland, various versions of eyelash wishing rituals existed, each with its own specific instructions. In parts of England, folklore advised individuals place a loose eyelash on the back of their hand, make a wish, and then throw it over their shoulder. If the eyelash leaves the hand successfully, the belief was that the wish would come true, but if it became caught on something or didn't leave the back of the hand, then it wasn't going to come true.
Like if you had, you know, like mega queso on your hand.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So keep that in mind. In another popular version, the practice was that you would place the eyelash on the Eilish, Billie Eilish, on the tip of someone's nose and then blow it off. Uh-huh. And that same kind of deal. If it blew off easily and then that's fine. Your wish is going to come true. But if it sticks to something or then lands on your shoulder or something like that, then it wouldn't come true.
Does it have to be your eyelash?
Well, I mean, where are you getting eyelashes from,
sir? Well, that's my question. If I had a lot of wishes, I could just take them?
You are not to take eyelashes from someone or even yourself. Well, you can't take your own.
Well, not when they're awake. You know, I'd wait till they were sleeping and then extract as many lashes as I had wishes.
Kind of like a Mission Impossible or Gross Point Blank style mission where you'd come down from
the ceiling.
No, you're not allowed to do that. It has to come off of the eyelid naturally. It's part of the rules.
Operation Wishlash.
J.K. Simmons was in that, I think. It was a really good performance.
The band instructor.
Yeah. In some folklore and superstition, there is a belief that the devil or evil spirits may try to collect personal items like hair to do harm to people. And the idea that you're blowing away an eyelash after making a wish is preventing the devil from obtaining it and potentially using it against you.
The devil has very poor eyesight.
Yeah. I mean, you've got one shot. You got to shoo away that devil.
Yep.
In various cultures, trees like the hawthorn in Scotland or the wish tree in Yorkshire have been associated with wishes and rituals, such as driving nails into them for good luck or making wishes while climbing them. Trees have held symbolic importance worldwide, and there's...
Lukey is looking to jump off his table nest.
Are you not having fun anymore?
He's like, yeah, all this talk about mega queso Cheetos.
Right. He's got places to go.
Yeah.
In Japan, during the Tanabata festival, wishes are written on paper strips and tied to bamboo shoots, reflecting the universal belief in trees as conduits for wishes and blessings.
Interesting.
Yeah. The practice of making wishes on the moon likely has ancient origins and is deeply rooted in, once again, various cultures and traditions. While it's challenging to again pinpoint the exact date or time that the practice began, references to moon-related rituals and beliefs can be found in historical texts, myths, and cultural practices dating back centuries. The moon has long been symbolic of magic, mysticism, and granting wishes in many societies, making it a significant celestial body in numerous cultures and spiritual traditions. Back to Japan, in Japanese culture, creating origami, 1,000 paper cranes is believed to fulfill a wish, which I think is kind of nice because you actually got to put some work in.
Boy, do
you. You know, you're not just like finding a stick and you're like, I'm going to make a wish on this stick.
Yeah.
You've got to make 1,000 paper cranes. And each crane symbolizes a year of life since the cranes are thought to live for 1,000 years. The tradition's name, called Senbazuru, translates to 1,000 cranes.
So you only get one wish?
Yeah.
For 1,000?
Per 1,000 cranes.
Yeah, I like my eyelash idea better.
Yeah.
It's much easier.
That tracks. In European folklore, ladybugs were often associated with the Virgin Mary and were seen as symbols of protection. It was believed that if a ladybug landed on a person, it was a sign of good luck and that a wish made at that moment would be granted. The number of spots on the ladybug was sometimes thought to represent the number of months before the wish would come true, which I hadn't heard that part of the myth. The tradition of making a wish on a ladybug spread to other cultures over time with variations on
the... I liked it better the first way.
Thank you. Yeah. Ladybugs are still seen as symbols of good luck and wishes in many parts of the world. Making a wish when a ladybug lands on you, I think it's a It's cute. But also my wish often is, I wish more ladybugs would land on me because they're so cute.
Yeah. I would much rather have several ladybugs land on me than some of these scarab beetles that we've seen here in Ecuador. Holy shit. Talk about nightmare fuel.
I love them so much.
Oh my. I keep thinking of The Mummy.
Oh yeah.
The movie,
yeah.
The Mummy.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Classic. One of my favorites. I keep finding them in a deceased form, and I want very much to
give them mouth to mouth.
No, or? to take one and like preserve it, but I don't know how, and I'm really worried it would end up gross.
Yeah,
and I want someone to know how to do it and to help me so that I will know that I'm not just bringing a decomposing bug into the house.
Somebody that, if there's anybody listening that has scarab beetle
preservation skills.
or taxidermy skills, please send us some info.
I don't know about taxidermy, but like if I could just dump resin over it or something, that would be my idea of a good time, because they're so cute and
you,
I love them.
You're easily pleased.
Anyway, in some cultures, people make wishes on rainbows. I've not heard of that one. Specific animals like turtles, or even certain days of the year, such as New Year's Day or certain festival days, are days where you're allowed to just make wishes all day, I guess.
Really?
I didn't know, but apparently I've got some wish making up to do. In some cultures, people might make wishes on lotus flowers, or on certain gemstones or crystals, on sacred mountains or rivers, even on traditional artifacts or symbols unique to their culture. People all over the world have made wishes on a variety of things, even though most of us acknowledge that it's not necessarily going to come true. And it's a way to express hope or desire for something positive. It adds a bit of whimsy to one's day. But the fact that so many people wish on various things, even though, you know, we're not sure that it's going to come to be, it reflects our love of tradition. And also, it's a form of optimism that we continue to do this, even though none of my birthday wishes ever came true once, ever.
And you blew all the candles out.
Yeah, consistently. Mm. I've got great lung capacity.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. As evidenced by our Zoom call with the freaks, the patrons, the inner circle of freaks, you screamed in my ear really, really loud.
Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
I got most of my information from Times of India, Family Peace Center, WikiHow, and Lunology.
Fascinating.
Thanks again to Kristen, who suggested it.
So I was 12 years old, and I had read somewhere that if you make a wish and you write it down and you tie it to a balloon and, you know, let it go, that
you've littered.
Well, yes, ultimately, but your wish would come true, so you wouldn't care that you were killing the earth, you know? So I didn't have any balloons, and you could, in Holton, Maine in those days, good luck finding helium-filled balloons.
Okay.
It just was not a thing.
Noted.
But being from Aroostook County,
you were ingenuitive.
I was very, I was a problem solver. And so what I did was I took a plastic dry cleaner's bag that was really light, and I built a frame with drinking straws.
Amazing.
And I put that over it. And then I put birthday candles along the cross on the bottom of it, and then tied my wish to it and lit the candles.
Oh, so you littered and likely started a forest fire.
I burned my neighbor's shrubs down.
No.
Yeah, I did. And interestingly, that was my wish, was to burn my neighbor's shrubs down. So dreams do come true, everyone.
You little geezer.
I was the terror on Park Street in Holton.
Glorious.
You hear Kat and I talk a lot about Aura Frames, and there's a reason for that. We live in Ecuador, and our family is all over the place. In fact, Kat right now is up visiting her mom. And when I say up, I mean Maine. we got her an Aura frame so we could share photos and videos from any device, and they'll instantly appear on the frame, which makes it easy because she's getting up there in years. It's easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes to set up a frame using the Aura app, and it's the perfect gift for Mother's Day. Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. It is the perfect gift for Mother's Day. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get 30% off free shipping and their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A, frames.com. Use code ODDITIES at checkout to save. That's A-U-R-A, frames.com, and use code ODDITIES at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I appreciate your letting me go first. Well, I don't get too often. Do you have a story for me now?
Yes, yes I do. And today I'm going to take you through the eerie mists of Huntsville, Alabama, and a playground that's located there that is nestled next to the oldest cemetery in the city, Maple Hill Cemetery.
Okay.
And this isn't just any regular run-of-the-mill playground. Locally, this playground is called the Dead Children's Playground.
I don't like that.
This spot is steeped in ghostly legends and spine-tingling tales that that draw people mostly from around Halloween to the site to see if they can see some of the reported sightings of dead ghosts. And
be weird if it wasn't a dead ghost, like a live ghost. The phrase "dead children's playground,"
yeah,
really, it creates an image in here that is not nice.
No,
and that there's skin coming off and there's chunks.
No, these are happy little children ghosts. From what I understand.
Oh, okay.
Let's dig into this. Maple Hill Cemetery, it sprawls across acres, and it's a witness to history since its establishment in 1822.
Wow.
It's the final resting place for generations, and it houses stories of the bygone eras etched into its ancient tombstones. It's really a beautiful cemetery.
Okay.
But they decided sometime in the 60s or late 50s that a really good place to put a playground is right next to a graveyard.
Yeah.
So, yeah, by day, it's a place of joy where laughter fills the air and children scamper about. But at night, the atmosphere shifts dramatically.
Okay.
Now, the exact year that the playground was built, the Dead Children's Playground, is not clearly documented, but the playground has been part of the local landscape adjacent to the cemetery for many decades. They know it's been there since at least the 60s.
Okay.
It might go back further, but it's become embedded in local lore, particularly from stories circulating about events and observations from the 1960s onward. It's mentioned in various anecdotes that the playground existed in some form during the mid-20th century. So okay, we know it's at least that old.
Okay.
And the playground's proximity to Maple Hill has given rise to chilling accounts of paranormal activities. The most pervasive stories involve the spirits of children who are said to frequent the playground when the veil between this world and the next thins during the nighttime, especially around 3 a.m, the witching hour.
Mm.
Witnesses have reported swings swaying gently with no breeze in sight, and the faint sounds of children's laughter echoing with no apparent source, and shadows moving subtly in the corner of one's eye. One particular tale involves a local who came to the playground at midnight hoping to debunk these myths.
Okay.
Instead, he left a believer. As he approached, he noticed that one of the swings began to move back and forth. But not just like it was blowing in the breeze. It was with significant force, as though an individual child was enjoying a nocturnal swing. You know, when we were kids, you get on a swing and you'd pump your legs and the swing would get higher and higher. And that's what it was doing. It was getting
higher.
Not just
when I was a kid, but no, like
still
last
today.
Week.
Yeah, last week.
We have a swing set down in the...
That's true.
The park.
Yeah, and
it's a nice one.
We finally WD-40'd it because it was driving us crazy.
Yeah. I can't tell if our neighbors think that we're just like helpful neighborly types or if we're just obnoxious and we're always down in the park like spraying WD-40 on stuff. And
I think it's a strong combination of both of those things.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Now, when this happened, when he saw the swing getting higher and higher, he said the air grew inexplicably cold and he could hear a soft giggle of a little girl floating through the air.
All right.
No rational explanation could account for the movement of the swing or the sudden drop in the temperature. So this guy walked away a believer. There's another story, too, of a young man who went to the cemetery in the playground in the middle of the night to see if he could see anything.
Okay.
And he was sitting there. He was, you know, maybe early to mid-teens.
Okay.
And he sees a little girl appear in the playground and walk toward him. And she looks completely alive, solid, no ghosty stuff.
It looks
totally alive.
She looks solid. That's how I was always described as a kid, too.
And for good reason.
Oh, she's solid.
Yeah. The only thing that was weird that he said was that she was wearing a dress that looked like it was out of date.
Okay.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
So she walks right up to him and she stopped and she said, "I know you." And then she wandered off and disappeared into the woods.
Okay.
So he goes home and the next morning at breakfast, he's telling his mom about this and he's describing the dress and she goes, blank white, pale.
Okay.
And went into another room and got a photo album and showed him a photo of a little girl in a dress like he had described.
Okay.
And he said, "Oh my God, yes, that's who I saw." And she said, "That was your sister and she died before you were born."
Uh-huh.
So.
It sounds like an R.L. Stein story. If we're being honest.
During the 60s, the playground adjacent to the cemetery became the focus of a somber, somber story. It was a time marked by unsettling occurrences, the disappearance of children in the community.
Oh.
Kids just started disappearing.
Okay.
And these events, of course, left a lasting mark on the collective memory of the Huntsville residents. And according to local stories, a series of mysterious child disappearances gripped the city. The community was fraught with sorrow and anxiety, and searches extended for days and then ultimately weeks. And then, in an even more harrowing development, some of the missing children, not all, but some of them were reportedly found deceased in the vicinity of the playground and the cemetery. The circumstances of these discoveries were shrouded in uncertainty. They thought that there was a local guy, a guy that lived in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
They considered him a suspect.
Right.
But ultimately, No charges were filed.
Interesting.
Now, of course, any community, and Huntsville is no exception, is affected deeply with this sense of loss, especially when there's really no closure. Shortly after that, the community began to talk about occurrences, unusual noises, and ghostly sightings, and an intense sense of unease when going to that playground.
Okay.
The unexplained nature of the children's disappearances and the discovery of their bodies near the playground have led to speculation, of course, that the spirits of the lost children lingered. And in the absence of any closure, many found it conceivable that the souls of these young kids clung to a familiar and once happy place, the playground.
Well, I think there being child murders in your town would give you an unsettled feeling, regardless of sturdy children ghosts or not.
Maybe that was a way for the community to process grief?
Possibly.
Makes some sense. There is also speculation that the playground was built over a section of the cemetery not documented in public records.
Uh-huh. Once again, we need to be better about marking cemeteries.
We do. So there's some speculation that the playground, when it was built, was constructed over unmarked graves of children from a forgotten time. Mm. And this theory is bolstered by the occasional reports of apparitions from wearing clothing from way back, like
I thought you were going to say like bones coming up or something, but no, it's
no,
just...
No, as far as I know.
Okay.
As far as I know.
Okay.
And then there's also this. In addition, numerous children who succumbed to the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic in Huntsville are interred in Maple Hill Cemetery. Plots that are just adjacent to the playground, right next to the playground. And it's said that after sundown, it's these spirits, these children, that emerge to frolic and play. Online searches reveal photographs capturing unexplained shadows and orbs.
What?
Yeah. And indeed, the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918, Huntsville got hammered by it. It claimed the lives of many children and adults alike. Global fatalities reaching, of course, 50 million. Huntsville was severely impacted by the outbreak, resulting in overcrowding of hospitals and exhausted medical professionals working tirelessly to alleviate the suffering of countless patients. The number of children who succumbed to the flu in Huntsville and were buried in Maple Hill Cemetery is estimated to be several hundred, in the hundreds. And this was just over a period slightly less than 2 months.
Oh, my gosh.
Can you imagine the devastation
That's
to a community?
That's huge.
The community, they've embraced the ghosts. Back in 2007, the city planned to renovate the playground. And there was an uproar, not just about the potential disruption to a beloved community spot, but also fear of disturbing the resting spirits. Renovations proceeded nonetheless, with modern equipment replacing the old, yet the hauntings still appear to continue undisturbed by human intervention. This acceptance of the playground's eerie reputation is a witness to Huntsville's unique relationship with its own history.
Yeah, and I love that idea. Like a community just going, I guess we got ghosts.
Yep, leave them be. The local community treats these ghostly children not with fear, but with a kind of a respectful camaraderie.
Aww.
Halloween, for instance, sees a surge of visitors, local and tourist alike, who come with cameras and voice recorders hoping to capture a paranormal play date. The Dead Children's Playground has attracted numerous paranormal investigators over the years, drawn by the stories of its active spirits. Many a skeptic has walked into the park under cover of night, only to emerge with stories that they can't explain, be it high readings on EMF detectors or cold spots or EVP recordings. They walk out thinking, maybe I'm not as skeptical. Maybe I'm not convinced, but maybe I'm not as skeptical. During one investigation, a team set up night cameras and recorded hours of footage while much of it was just uneventful crap. At precisely 2:03 a.m., the footage showed all the swings in synchronous motion despite the still humid air. An EVP session conducted at the same time captured a voice, small and clear, saying, "Let us play."
Have you seen the video of the swings?
No, I can't find it.
Cool.
But in all fairness, I haven't looked that hard yet.
Sure.
I will before we release this. And if I can find it, I will include it. This is a place where the past is palpable. The line between folklore and reality blurs, and whether you believe in ghosts or not, the playground offers a unique window into a community's cultural psyche, embodying the human need to find meaning and connection in the face of mortality. And there were some pretty horrific things over the decades.
Yeah, it's no wonder that there is kind of a collective funk.
Yeah.
Because that's a lot to deal with as a community.
And all of these stories surrounding the Dead Children's Playground, it's worth considering why these particular tales resonate so deeply with those people who hear them. And perhaps it's the unsettling juxtaposition of the innocence of a playground and the backdrop of a cemetery. And like you said at the beginning of the episode, when I said Dead Children's Playground, you said, "Oh, that gives me quite a..."
The imagery.
Disturbing mental image. And, you know, maybe it's just the universal chill that courses through our spines as the thought of little kids as ghosts, unresolved and restless, playing in the shadows of the night. Mm.
I also just think that when you go to a playground and you can see a cemetery, it is a weird juxtaposition of imagery.
Yep.
And just that, even if there weren't a history of child disappearances and there weren't a history of, you know, illness that took out a majority of the kids, there would still be a, "Gosh, that's weird."
Yeah.
And I would imagine would be very easy for people to come up with stories.
Oh, yeah.
Just because of the proximity.
Yeah, exactly. Years ago, I worked with a guy who knew Stephen King really well. And he said, he was telling Stephen King that Kentucky Fried Chicken or a KFC location in his hometown, when they would have large families, like maybe a celebration of some sort, that they would borrow extra seats from next door, the funeral home.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would bring these funeral home seats over to Kentucky Fried Chicken. And Stephen King says, "That's where I get my ideas from." That kind of crazy shit.
Yeah.
And I can see that becoming a Stephen King short story.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I got my sources here for you. Maple Hill Cemetery Historical Records, the local Huntsville paranormal groups that have posted, and the City of Huntsville Archives.
We love you, Huntsville, and we owe you a visit.
We do. We had a show scheduled for Huntsville, and we had to cancel it.
Yeah.
I love that the locals treat this playground with reverence.
Yeah.
You know, that's really
nice. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
What? Keep rumbling, 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 rumbling. Now I know y'all be loving this shit right here. L-I-M-P, Biscuit is right here. People in the house, put your hands in the air. If you don't care, then we don't care.
What you got for me?
That was Rollin' by Limp Bizkit.
That's very, very nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's March 1st in the town of Beatrice, Nebraska. In the afternoon, the Reverend Walter Klempel had gone to the Westside Baptist Church to get things ready for choir practice. Most of the singers were in the habit of arriving around 7:15, and it was chilly in the church, so Klempel lit the furnace and went home to dinner so that the church would have time to warm up before the choir members arrived.
Right.
Now, when I was a small person, my mom cleaned one of the local churches, and I would go with her often, and churches are cold.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Especially old churches.
Oh.
In Maine? Yeah.
Even in the summertime, like, you would open the doors to the churches and this blast of cold air would come out at you because if they didn't have to, well, why would they?
Plus, it's full of ghosts.
There's that, too.
Let's be honest here.
Yeah. As I said, choir members would generally gather by 7:15, and Klempel liked to be at the church before they arrived. However, it was like 7:10, and the time approached for him to return to the church with his wife and daughter, Marilyn Ruth, and a sudden snag arose. Marilyn Ruth discovered that her dress was soiled, and so they had to wait for Mrs. Klempel, to iron another outfit, delaying their departure and keeping them at home. Another choir member, Mrs. Leonard Schuster, who typically arrived at the church around 7:20 with her daughter Susan, had to deviate from her routine on this specific evening. Mrs. Schuster's mother was preparing for another project for church, and she was getting missionary meeting stuff together, and the three were delayed at her house with that work. Meanwhile, LaDonna Vandergrift, who was a high school sophomore, she found herself entangled in a geometry problem. And despite her usual punctuality, knowing that practice started promptly, she opted to stay back to make sure that her homework was finished before she left for choir practice. Lucille Jones and Dorothy Wood, also high school students and neighbors who typically attended practice together, had their routine disrupted. Lucille was engrossed in a 7 to 7:30 radio show, and she decided to prioritize finishing the show, causing a delay in their usual prompt departure. But Dorothy was there with her. She had no choice to wait with her tardy friend. Rowena Estes was all set for choir practice. She encountered a hiccup as her car refused to start. Consequently, she and her sister reached out to LaDonna Vandergrift for a ride. However, because LaDonna was engrossed in the geometry problem, the Estes sisters had no choice but to wait for their transportation to arrive when it arrived. Sadie Estes had a similar problem to Rowena's. Throughout the day, they faced car troubles, and their vehicle stubbornly refused to start.
Wow.
Machinist Harvey All was tasked with looking after his two boys while his wife was away, and he intended to bring them to practice, but he got caught up in a conversation, losing track of time, and it was only when he glanced at his watch that he realized that he was running late. Herbert Kift, the lathe operator of the group, could have been early, but he was getting ready to leave the house and he thought of a unfinished letter that he had started earlier in the day. And he had opted to procrastinate earlier. And he, for some reason, was like, you know what, I should go finish this letter before I leave for choir practice. And that resulted in him running a little bit behind. As I mentioned, it was quite chilly that day, and Joyce Black, who worked as a stenographer, was embracing her inner laziness. Mm. She did not want to go out in the cold, and I don't blame her. She wanted to linger in the warmth of her home until the very last minute, and she did. She just kind of hunkered down and decided she would leave when she was damn well ready. Pianist Marilyn Paul had planned to be a half hour early, but she actually fell asleep after dinner. And her mother woke her at 7:15, leaving Marilyn with just enough time to tidy up and rush out the door. Consequently, both she and Mrs. F.E. Paul, the choir director, were late because the daughter's tardiness affected them both. As Marilyn and her mother were getting ready to leave their home together, they heard the blast. At 7:25 p.m., the empty church exploded.
Oh, my God.
The deafening blast echoed throughout the town of Beatrice. The walls of the church fell outward, and the heavy wooden roof crashed straight down like a weight in a deadfall. The force shattered windows in nearby buildings and disrupted a local radio station. It was so intense.
Wow.
Initial assessments by the fire department suggested that the explosion might have resulted from a natural gas leak that seeped into the church from a damaged pipe outside, possibly ignited by the furnace fire that had been started earlier.
Wow.
So because of an unfinished letter, a geometry problem, a stalled car, a dirty dress, etc., every single member of the choir, all 15 of them, were late, something that had never occurred before in choir practice history.
That's an amazing story.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah. Oh, how do you even begin to figure the odds of something like that happening? It must be astronomical.
Absolutely.
Unreal.
Yeah. And I bet Klempel, though not his fault at all that the fire or the blast happened,
right,
was so grateful that we were embracing our inner laziness, that we soiled our dress, that, you know, because, I mean, essentially he had started that fire that, you know, well, yeah, you get what I'm saying.
I certainly do.
So it's absolutely incredible. And I got my information from Medium magazine, Bluefield Daily Telegraph, Snopes, which fact checked this.
Yeah.
And thanks to Sunny D, who sent me the inspiration for this story.
You know, the world is full of stories.
Yeah.
Sweetie.
I hear that pretty often, actually.
And now, that thing in the middle.
It seems that there's a special interest group for everyone nowadays. Case in point, the Antique Barbed Wire Society. The Antique Barbed Wire Society, according to their website, is an international organization committed to collecting, preserving, exhibiting, and interpreting the historical heritage of barbed wire and barbed wire-related items. In fact, they have a barbed wire museum, which is located in La Crosse, Kansas, and was established in 1970. The museum focuses on barbed wire, and they have over 2,000 different forms of wire and its history. Thanks, Antique Barbed Wire Society.
There are really many reasons to listen to our podcast, Big Picture Science. It's kind of a challenge to summarize them all, Molly.
Okay, here's a reason to listen to our show, Big Picture Science, because you love to be surprised by science news. We love to be surprised by science news. So, for instance, I learned on our own show that I had been driving around with precious metals in my truck before it was stolen.
That was brought up in our show about precious metals and also rare metals, like most of the things in your catalytic converter. I was surprised to learn that we may begin naming heat waves like we do hurricanes. You know, prepare yourself for heat wave Lucifer.
I don't think I can prepare myself for that.
Look, we like surprising our listeners. We like surprising ourselves by reporting new developments in science. And while asking the big picture questions about why they matter and how they will affect our lives today and in the future.
Well, we can't affect lives in the past, right?
No, I guess that's a point. So the podcast is called Big Picture Science, and you can hear it wherever you get your podcasts.
We are the hosts. Seth is a scientist. I'm a science journalist. And we talk to people smarter than us. We hope you'll take a listen.
Hello, everyone. It's Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.
If this podcast were at Costco or Sam's Club, you'd get scads of podcasts at once for a dollar. But they'd come shrink-wrapped on big pallets and block your driveway. And you'd grow to hate us. There's a reason we upload these babies one at a time. This is The Box of Oddities.
Deep in the heart of the Amazon, there are stories of a creature both formidable and revered. This creature is known as the Yakumama.
Yakumama. I like that.
Yakumama.
Yakumama.
That means mother of the waters.
Okay.
It's said to be the Amazon River's guardian spirit, a serpent of unimaginable size. Its Ooh. Tails are as wide and meandering as the river itself. Now, being a guy who's kind of interested in cryptozoology and have been since I was a kid, I find the Yakumama to be one of the most captivating of cryptozoology stories.
Yeah, and you knew I'd like it because I just like snakes.
Could this legendary serpent be more than just a figment of the imagination? The legend speaks of a snake so colossal that it could surround a man with just a small part of its body, and so powerful it could create whirlpools to drown the unwary. Fishermen from tribes along the Amazon speak of the Yakumama with a mix of fear and respect, recounting stories that have been passed on down through generations. One elder of the Sequoia tribe once shared with a journalist, quote, "I have seen the Yakumama as wide as a man is tall. Her scales glisten like the wet leaves after a rainstorm. She swirled the water into a vortex, and I knew then to steer clear of her domain." It's said that the vortex that this alleged creature can create is so strong, it draws fish into it. It's like a whirlpool.
Oh, wow.
They can't get out. The legend of the Yakumama is not a tale for the faint of heart, nor is it one to be dismissed lightly, for the stories that cling to this colossal serpent are as old as the river itself, pretty much woven right into the fabric of the Amazonian lore. In the tangled green forest of the Amazon, among communities that have stood for centuries, the Yakumama is spoken of in tones that are laced with an ancient blend of fear and veneration.
Mm.
It's said that to behold the Yakumama is to glimpse a primeval force, a being so massive that it could easily kill a man. Its thickness has also been compared to that of a giant tree trunk. Its length, almost an endless undulation of muscles and scales. The stories are that this snake could be as big as 100 feet long.
What? Well, that sounds more like Titanoboa.
It do. Fishermen whose lives are linked to the ebb and flow of the river's tides recount the Yakumama. They talk about the dark shapes beneath the water's surface. They talk of sudden disappearances of wildlife attributed to the serpent's hunger. They also talk about villagers who have disappeared.
Oh.
Some of them were witnessed to be struggling with something in the water and then pulled down and were never seen again.
Okay. Well, the Amazon houses a huge variety of animals, and its shores provide habitat for a lot of things that might want to take you under the water surface.
That is true. And for the local peoples of the Amazon, the Yakumama is as real as the river itself. It's they point to the fact that so much of the Amazon is untamed.
Mm.
And it's a reminder that there are still so many mysteries out there.
Yeah.
Way beyond what we can grasp. We're finding new species there all of the time. Skeptics and scientists may dismiss the tales as fanciful imaginations of people deeply intertwined with the rhythms of the rainforest. They point to the green anaconda.
Yep.
The non-mythical giant that dwells in the same murky waters as the likely source of these stories. And indeed, the green anaconda is an impressive beast.
Oh, she's sturdy.
Oh, sturdy indeed. Documented lengths of up to 30 feet.
Yeah.
And a well-earned reputation as one of the rainforest's most formidable apex predators.
That's right. OTEP, bitch.
These giant snakes are masters of their aquatic domain, capable of lurking in the shallows for unsuspecting prey. Their method of ambush is the stuff of my nightmares. They strike swiftly, enveloping their quarry with lightning-quick coils, and start suffocating it in a muscular embrace. And every time its prey exhales,
it's tighter,
tighter and tighter. Reports of anacondas attacking humans are rare, but not unheard of. Mm-hmm. There are local stories sometimes that emerge of fishers or swimmers who have vanished. Their last moments marked by a struggle in the water, and speculation inevitably turns to the anaconda, pretty much a silent assassin of the Amazon.
Plus piranha. Piranha live in the Amazon.
They sure do.
And they want to eat you.
But the locals talk about the Yakumama as being a serpent of such grand scale that it could swallow an adult caiman, like a snake might a fish.
Mm-hmm.
They say that even though the anaconda is very, very large, it's nowhere near as big as the Yakumama.
Okay.
Could there, in the uncharted corners of the Amazon, exist a creature that transcends the boundaries of biology as we know it? Could the Yakumama be an echo of an ancient lineage of serpents, a living relic from a time when the world was younger and wilder?
Do you mean Titanoboa?
Yeah. The notion that the Yakumama could be an as yet undiscovered descendant of Titanoboa is a tantalizing one. And
I'm booking a flight right now.
It's steeped in the allure of cryptozoology and the mysteries of the dense Amazonian rainforests and what they still conceal. And the idea of this being a possibility hinges on the prospect that a line of giant serpents descended from Titanoboa managed to survive the vast changes that the Earth underwent over millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, such survival would require a consistent habitat that would provide the necessary warmth and food supply that a large constrictor would need.
Right.
The Amazon, with its ancient lineage and relatively stable tropical climate, could theoretically serve as such a sanctuary.
Uh-huh.
For a descendant of Titanoboa to remain undetected until modern times, it would have had to adapt significantly. It may have developed more effective camouflage or learned to avoid humans and other threats, perhaps becoming nocturnal or favoring the most remote and inaccessible parts of the rainforest.
Mm.
Its diet and behavior would have evolved to align with the modern ecosystem of the Amazon, potentially explaining why evidence of its existence, such as remains of prey or shed skins, have not been discovered.
Well, remains of prey, if like Titanoboa could consume a crocodile in one bite.
That's it.
Like, that's blam. So there wouldn't be any remains of prey. It would just be
gone.
Done.
Yeah. And then there'd be some big snake doogie.
Ugh, that snake poop is the worst smelling thing on this planet.
Yeah, I remember you picked a snake up and it peed all over you once, and I wouldn't let you get back in the car.
Yeah, that was unfortunate.
Yeah, it was a long walk home for you. The continuous habitation of the Amazon by indigenous people over millennia means that cultural narratives such as the Yocomama could represent an unbroken chain of observation stretching back to a time when larger-than-life serpents may have been a more common sight. Mm. If the Yocomama is a descendant of Titanoboa, then its presence in local mythology could be a testament to the longevity of the species and its impact on the human psyche and society.
Yeah.
Kind of like a cultural memory.
That makes perfect sense. Also, the Amazon is wild.
It is.
And uncharted in so many spots. And there are so many things that are there that we have no idea about. And it's so lush and dense. And it, so you could just like scootle in and, oh, there's a new thing that we didn't even know was a thing.
Yeah. Or you could scootle in and get eaten by Titanoboa.
That's possible too.
Biologically.
But, I mean, if you're going to go.
Really? That's the way you'd want to go? You would want to be eaten alive by a snake?
I mean, a Titanoboa? That's pretty neat.
You'd consider that an honor.
It's pretty neat.
Well, biologically, it's not entirely inconceivable for an isolated population of a large species to remain hidden, especially in a place as vast and unexplored as the Amazon. New species are discovered regularly, suggesting that the rainforest still harbors many, many secrets.
Well, yeah.
The significant challenges to this theory can't be overlooked, though. The fossil record shows no immediate forms between Titanoboa and present-day snakes, suggesting that if such descendants exist, they have done so without leaving any trace in the geological record.
Okay.
Moreover, the Amazon has been extensively studied by biologists and ecologists, and while much remains to be learned, the likelihood of an apex predator of such size remaining undetected by scientific inquiry is possible, but exceedingly slim.
Says you.
Yeah, no, not me, says skeptics. The concept of a giant water serpent is not confined to the Amazon. Africa talks about the Mokele Mbembe. North America talks about the Lake Champlain monster.
Champy.
These legends spread across different continents and cultures, suggest a collective human memory of prehistoric megafauna or a common mythic structure that speaks to our innate fear and fascination with the unknown. While concrete evidence for the Yocomama remains elusive, the Amazon continues to yield new species and hinting at possibilities that lie in the uncharted waters. Reports from locals who have claimed to have seen serpents much larger than the known anacondas provide fodder for ongoing debates in cryptozoology and the scientific communities. Could the Yocomama be a relic of the Pleistocene epoch? Or are these sightings merely misidentifications of well-known species while the observer is in the throes of fear?
Or maybe it's a combination of the two.
Could be.
Maybe it is not quite Yocomama-y, and maybe it's not something that we are familiar with. Maybe it's somewhere in between. It's probably Yocomama.
I've got to say, you know, one thing's for certain. I will never get into the Amazon River. Never.
Well, you're not going to get into it. Like in a boat, you would.
A big enough boat, not a dugout canoe. It would have to be an old-fashioned paddle steamer.
You know what I would trust? An Old Town canoe made in Old Town, Maine.
Yep. The people, they like the Old Town canoes.
They sure do. And they should. They're awesome.
I got my information from The Archaeologist, Wikipedia, and Ancient Origins.
Gosh, that was fun.
Yeah. Big giant ass snake.
I don't hate that idea.
I hate it so much you wouldn't believe it. Anyway, you guys, we appreciate you hanging out with us for another episode of Box of Oddities. And if you've joined us on YouTube, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We do appreciate that as we try to grow that as well. Any help you can give us, share it with your friends, subscribe, you know all that stuff.
You know all the stuff. Yeah. Hit the buttons. And if you wanted to interact with it, maybe comment about how awesome it would be to be consumed by a snake.
Or comment on how dangly Kat's earrings were. She's taking them off now. Anyway, we'll see you next time.
Until then, keep flying that freak flag.
Fly it proudly, you beautiful freak.
And so, let it be known that the Box of Oddities belongs to you, and its fate is in your hands. Therefore, it's been requested by those to whom I report to beseech you for assistance. We ask but one thing of you, to provide a 5-star rating and a positive review. True, that is two things. However, 'tis merely a 5-star rating and a positive review. Also, subscribe to us. Okay, so three things is all we ask. Three things and three things only. We wish to offer our deeply felt gratitude and appreciation for your patronage. TheBoxOfOddities.com. On Facebook at Facebook.com/Box of Oddities Podcast and Instagram at Box of Oddities Podcast. Copyright 2024. All rights reserved.
There's an Amazon riverboat cruise. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a WWF cruise, so you know it's pricey. $8,500.
To cruise with wrestlers?
Woo! I'm hungry.
Have you ever wondered how inbred the Habsburgs really were? What women in the past used for birth control? Or what Queen Victoria's 9 children got up to? On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ+ royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. Join me every Tuesday for History Tea Time, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that because you're already listening to a podcast.